This is an ABC podcast.
High rental prices is forcing more people out on the street. And for some, home is now camping out in State Forest.
I've got the fire. I've got my hot water bottle, which is my little dog. You know, you rug up. You don't mind roughing it a bit. Would I want to live here, like, permanently? Maybe I have to.
And the benefits of including local language in the classroom.
I don't have any Indigenous heritage that I know of or are aware of. If I never learned Dogra, I'd be looking at the same how the world is, just the same how as I know it now, just technology and blah, blah, blah. But when I learn Dogra, you can just look all the way out in the country and you can see what's really there.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide.
Today and tomorrow, there's a big polar air mass that's pushing over southeastern Australia, and it's causing a big drop in temperatures and widespread snow, rain, damaging winds all in the mix.
That's Ben Domenzino, a meteorologist with WeatherZone, discussing the cold front that's sweeping over the southeast of the country at the moment. Temperatures have dropped and we're seeing strong snowfalls across vast areas of the high country and possible falls in areas as far north as Queensland's Granite Belt. Such heavy snow falling on the mountains just days from the ski season opening would normally see a rush of people to the slopes, but tours from Melbourne that usually flock to the Alpine regions are few and far between. Michael O'Sullivan owns and operates a chalet in Bright, and he spoke to Erin Somerville about the abnormal start to the ski season.
Not normal. Lead up to winter, long weekend, the hype, especially with snow looking like it's going to be on the ground. So it's been a difficult couple of weeks since the lockdown in Melbourne. Even though we've been released from the lockdown, people have not come to the area. Everybody's nervous, especially interstate guests. Autumn here was amazing. People supported us, especially after last year's bushfires. And winter last year, we got 3 days and they closed the mountains. So we lost last year's winter. Of course, we're all in lockdown at that point. So we're hoping this year will be a bumper season for snow and for guests coming here to ski.
Tell us about the guest numbers that you've had in the past couple of weeks. You did have people who were here and then lockdown was announced.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
We specialise in group tours, Probus clubs and different groups and school groups. And we were pretty solidly booked all the way through till the school holidays. And then in school holidays, we expect to have families and skiers coming up. So all our groups, of course, had to cancel. All our food was purchased beforehand, so that's all wasted. But generally, everybody stops coming away when the lockdown happens. I guess we're well trained, but that's nobody's around at all. Even though we can have guests, as you can see, the restaurant's nothing happening.
What kind of pressure does that put on your business?
Well, since last year's lockdown, it's a week-by-week cash flow situation. So we've got 11 months' worth of back bills to catch up for people. But while we're running our business now, we've got our current bills. The government incentives and grants, they were all very good and helpful, but like this latest grant, $3,500, that doesn't cover anything whatsoever in a business like ours. All the on-costs, like work cover, superannuation, that still all had to be met by us. When we weren't earning any money whatsoever. So we're still catching up on all that sort of thing. So when you have a good week, half of what you get goes to pay for last year, as 11 months, and then other half just goes to keep running and paying current bills. So every week, we work from week to week. So the last 2 weeks, we've had nothing come in.
You were mentioning people have already cancelled, but
Oh, yes.
Are people getting nervous and cancelling bookings that are a few weeks ahead?
Yeah, right up till the end of June. School holidays, people are cancelling already.
And it really is important for this winter to perhaps help recoup some of the losses from COVID last year, plus the bushfires. So how devastating is it for this lockdown to have happened just before the ski season kicked off?
Financially, it was bad, but emotionally, it was worse because people remember back to what happened last year. You know, a lockdown, the mountains closed, so it's gone for the whole season. And once you close a ski resort down, you can't open it up again because all the workers are sent off. You can't turn it around. And the mountain can't afford to stay open without guests there. The cost to running a ski resort are absolutely horrific.
Chalet owner Michael O'Sullivan, he's in Bright, and he was speaking there with Aaron Somerville.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
High rental prices in many parts of the country has forced more Australians out of their homes. In the Cuppernock State Forest in New South Wales, a transient group of people made homeless through life circumstances are camping. And with other campsites in the area closed due to flood, damaged roads and landslips, they've no place left to go and are having to negotiate with forestry to extend their stay beyond 1 month. Wiria Sati spoke to two men willing to share their story, and their names are Mick and Eric.
How much you got left?
Mick sits by an open fire in the afternoon sun with an improvised corrugated tin wind guard they've dubbed the Ned Kelly. He tends to his toe with antiseptic, an injury from getting firewood, he tells me. He's been sharing this fire and marquee with a few others for about 6 weeks now, sleeping in a camp trailer with his little dog, Tiny. I ask him how he ended up here.
Became homeless, had a stroke, went to public housing. They put me up the list, but they still said 2-year waiting list. And the rents are shot up, and you can't really afford what private rental's got to offer.
Eric is a former interstate truck driver and oyster farmer, but he's been living this homeless life, rotating between properties and campgrounds for 3 or 4 years now. Are you sort of actively looking for a new place to live or...?
No, I can't afford it.
Yeah.
Like, no one's going to give rent to a bloke that's on the dole. Two dogs and no money, like just a dole, so...
What happens when the ranger comes?
Oh, she's pretty understanding, like if you've got problems or something, but yeah, I try to move on when I'm supposed to, but yeah.
Were you rotating between another place?
Yeah, a couple of places. There's Swan's Crossing and there's a couple other little spots, there we go.
A lot of the pre-camping sites where you can shift around are closed because of all the rain and the roads and landslips and stuff, so it just makes it harder because you can't really move around.
How long can you stay here?
Supposed to only stay a month. But with my toe and a few medical conditions, I can't move at the moment. So I just have to stay put and hopefully they won't kick me out. Yeah, there's a lot of them here that have been here for quite a while, but yeah, I don't want to get them in trouble. But yeah, so we're just stuck. If there were more campsites open, we probably wouldn't be in this situation. We'd be able to move around and we wouldn't have any trouble with the powers that be to forestry.
Forestry Corporation's Sandra Maddeley told the ABC there has been an increase in longer-term campers within Cuppernock Forest. She says they understand that some people may be experiencing hardship and do their best to engage with compassion by permitting extended stays to campers facing difficulties and providing information to help them connect with community support services. She adds that they cannot allow people to camp indefinitely, so they enforce reasonable length stays for forest visitors. Eric is on sickness benefits while he waits for knee surgery, which is coming up next month, but he doesn't have a house to go back to for his recovery.
I've got to go in and get a new knee next month, first of next month, and I'm trying to get some emergency housing or something like that for after it, but if not, I'll just have to set up here and come back when we get out of the hospital, so... You know, like it's with all the floods and that, emergency houses are going to be pretty hard to get for anyone to get. So, yeah, there's millions of people going for houses, and I've got this, like, oh, mate's led me this. So, I'm pretty happy with that for the time being. But, yeah, nice and high and dry. So,
how long have you had that caravan for?
Not long. It's a mate of mine. He's let me stay in it. That's pretty good for me. I don't mind that.
What were you doing before that?
Just a swag and a thing, like marquee.
So you guys have formed a pretty tight friendship, just all sharing a space, really?
Yeah, we're community cooking and, play a bit of cards or whatever and, keep ourselves some mirrors, go and get firewood. And, yeah.
What card game's your favourite?
Ayuga.
Mate, do you need anything?
No, I'm pretty right.
I'll give you some powdered milk.
Yeah?
You know, just powdered milk.
We've got you.
I asked Mick about any unsaid code for living in a community like this, and he tells me it's about give and take.
We've got unwritten laws, sort of like, be good to each other, don't get really drunk and yell out and stuff like that. Sort of like look after each other, watch each other's stuff, make sure everyone's all right. If you go down the shop, ask the ones that you know whether they want anything,
And what are some of the challenges you come across living in a place like this?
It would be storing food, fuel, the cold. Last night was pretty cold.
With winter approaching, do you need to take extra measures or is there something you can...
I got 3 doonas, I got the fire, I got my hot water bottle, which is my little dog. You rug up. You don't mind roughing it a bit. It's quite nice. Would I want to live here, permanently? Maybe I have to. But I'd like a little place.
Where is Sati there, speaking to Mick and Eric in the Kupernook State Forest in New South Wales. After nearly 6 years, a battle over the location of a controversial go-kart track has drawn to a close. The Bathurst Regional Council first proposed building the track at Mount Panorama in 2015, but some Aboriginal people say it's a sacred site. They took their fight to block the idea to the Federal Environment Minister, Susan Ley, who last month signed a 10-year protection order. Now the Aboriginal group, which opposed the track's location, the club and the council, all say they're looking to the future. Molly Gorman spoke to the Mayor, Bobby Burke, about the council decision not to appeal the order.
Look, we had minimal appeal rights from day one with the Section 10 when it was, when we asked for an appeal. And look, that has lapsed now, and we need to get on with it. We will move away from the go-kart track site where it is at the moment, and we'll assess if there's any other area.
Do you think that it was a mistake?
No, I don't think it was a mistake. Council did all the right procedures, and no, I don't think so.
So what next for this process?
What next is there's a report coming up to council next week. We're still in the draft process for doing that. And look, I know there is other councillors looking to put a notice of motion in on another accessible site for the go-kart track. We'll wait and see what happens from that.
For the Wiradjuri Traditional Owners Central West Aboriginal Corporation, the council's decision to accept the protection order is the final chapter in a long, hard-fought battle. Here's Yana Darambul Jade Flynn speaking about the corporation's thoughts on the end of the process.
My response after the 28-day period in which they could have had a response has been really positive. I think the community should celebrate the fact that there's going to be 10 years of protection for this, community asset. It's been a little bit stressful, knowing, that there was posturing from council towards an appeal, and given the raft of unwise decisions that have been made in the past, it wouldn't have been surprising if they did make an appeal. So I'm glad that they've stuck by what they said and quote-unquote accepted the umpire's decision.
What do you think this could mean for other applications around the country?
We hope that other groups can take encouragement from the process that we've been through and learn from, what we've gone through to get to this point. The law works, obviously. That's what it's there for. We made an appeal and the minister's made the right decision and the protection has been put in place. So we hope that other groups feel like they can draw inspiration from what's happened here and also, get in touch with us if we can help.
The council, it looks like, will be sort of discussing an alternative site at the upcoming council meeting. Have you had any thoughts about where it could go, the go-kart track?
So we've provided a list of alternative sites to council via our legal team. So we believe that there are quite a number of areas that would be appropriate for a go-kart facility. And we, you know, we're happy to work with council and the kart club to find, you know, the right spot. We hope that an appropriate management plan gets put into place and implemented to, you know, protect the area. And we look forward to, you know, the community being able to enjoy it and for Aboriginal and Wiradjuri women to be able to continue their religious practice in the area. I really hope a solution is found and quickly for the kart club. This, none of this is their doing. I know the corporation has indicated in the past, and we still indicate today, that we're happy to work with all players to find a really good solution for that club, because they deserve a proper good track in Bathurst.
Mark Dunbar is the president of the Bathurst Kart Club. He says the club's hopeful they'll end up with a track somewhere.
Yeah, the minister made a decision, and I think the club and the council, I think, are abiding by that decision now. I think there's been enough money spent up there on top of the mount, doing all the studies, trying to make sure that there was nothing there and all the rest of it. But the decision the minister made was different to the way we thought it would go. But anyway, we are disappointed, but we'll battle on from here.
What are your hopes moving forward?
We've had some very successful talks with a few of the councillors, but we'll wait until they call us in. We've been in for one meeting, and then they'll most probably call us in again, and then we'll sit down and discuss alternative sites. There wasn't that many alternative sites when we first started, but I'm quite sure the council will work through something and make something happen. It has taken a long time to get to where it got to. Like, it was the 11th hour. We literally had the bulldozed at the front gate, but like I say, the minister made the decision, so we've got to abide by that decision. Now it sort of seems that we've got to start again, but the committee and a lot of the members in the club are going, well, okay, let's keep at it. Like, let's make this thing happen. There's, like I've said countless times, there's some members in the club that have been trying to get a track in Bathurst for the last 20-odd years. Like I say, the club is still mad keen to see this thing happen, and we have a lot of support out of the club as well as internal in the club.
Molly Gorman reporting there from Bathurst.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
You're with me, Sinead Mangan. Bermagui Public School in regional New South Wales is one of a growing number of schools to offer students local Aboriginal language classes after decades of revitalisation work. When Ewan Mann, Gordon Campbell, was a student at Bermagui, there was no opportunity to learn local Aboriginal language and culture in the classroom. When he returned to the school as a teacher's aide in 2019, he had studied the Dooraga language at TAFE and was asked to introduce a language programme for the Bermagui Public School students. Now, every student at the school takes part in a half-hour language class each week. Vanessa Milton spoke to Gordon Campbell and some of the students at the school.
Wallawani Nindiwan Nyaga Buddy. I'm in year 5 at Burmy Public School. We've been learning Dooraga since 2019, and the person who taught us was Gordon Campbell. That's my uncle.
My name's Gordon Campbell. My family are traditionally from here, so I'm a Ewan man from the south coast here. I started off here as a teacher's aide, and the teacher I was working with, Miss Loughran, was interested in incorporating Aboriginal perspectives in her curriculum. And I've done a lot of previous work with the Dooraga language. I've been working in schools for about 14, 15 years, and then probably the last 5 or 6 years just taken on board doing the Dooraga language, which is one of the Ewan languages on the south coast. When I was at primary school here, we didn't learn much Aboriginal language. Only learned Aboriginal language from the other kids, older kids, teaching it to us. High school, we couldn't even get enough class to have Aboriginal studies in my senior years. So now, seeing all this stuff out and about, it's great.
I'm Brendan Constable, Principal Bermagui Public School. When we started doing the Dirga language, we were also in the process of getting approval to do the Welcome to Country and Acknowledgement to Country in one of our local languages. So I had spoken with Merriman's Land Council and they gave them permission for us to do that. The Dirga language program had the opportunity arose for us to bring it into the school, and I thought it was a great opportunity for the children to learn another language, and it was really very special that we could actually use one of our local languages.
I've seen their interest in Aboriginal culture just bloom. A lot of the kids here I've helped out 2 years ago with doing a couple of songs and that kind of thing, and they still walk around today singing it in their heads.
Wallawani Nindiwan Nayaga Izzy. I'm in Year 5 at Bumi Public School. Dirga is really cool to learn because it's different languages, different letters and stuff, different sounds. I reckon it gives me kind of a sense of connection to the people who have been here a long time ago. We're awakening Dirga language and Aboriginal language back into this world.
Wallawani Nindiwan Nyagadru. I don't have any Indigenous heritage that I know of or are aware of. If I never learned Dirga, I'd be looking at the same how the world is just the same how as I know it now, just technology and blah, blah, blah. But when I learned Dirga, you can just look all the way out in the country and you can see what's really there.
In the early morning, Buddha and Bariga talk and eat nectar from the awakening flowers.
Shai Badalama Waraga nibble on dewy grass.
As Guganyal Bara laugh at the morning sun from hype in the Gudira.
A kayaker launches in the still water below Guliga.
Wild Ozi Guruban Bara sleep in the Eldorani.
In the blue sky, Murum Baraga buzz around making Garwongo.
Multicoloured Guna Guni Warriga shimmer in the rock pools and out in the deep Baranjang Sea.
My teachings, I don't like to teach them just to the Indigenous kids, mainly because I'd like it to continue on and reawaken the Dirga language here on the South Coast. So my perspective of it all is that if I teach it to everyone, it's spread around and everyone gets a chance and it keeps it alive.
It gives our local Indigenous children the pride in their own culture and share that with others, but it's important to us as a school because we have a really good connection with our local community, and this is a really important and significant part of that. It's important to learn where we've come from, where everybody's come from. We're multicultural here at Bermagui School as well, and we have many different cultures. Now, this is our local, one of our local languages, but it's a part of our local culture from this area, so it's hugely important for our students. It also allows all of our kids to appreciate and respect our past and what's happened and understand where everybody comes from as they come to school. To be a part of this school and to be leading this school at the moment makes me very, very, very proud. I grew up in a small town just north of here, and many of my friends, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, grew up in this area, and I'm really proud of our school teaching this language right through our school, and I see that in elders and other people in our local community that I've known all of my life, and they're just so excited for us and excited for their kids because they get to experience this and they're taught this language and a part of the local culture. So I'm very proud of our school and very proud of our staff members and our students that are taking it on and doing a great job. On behalf of Bermagui Public School, we'd like to thank Merriman's, Red Cross, Bega Valley Shire, who have all been working really hard and supporting this and providing the funding so that we are able to conduct it right across our school.
And you heard there UN language teacher Gordon Campbell, Bermagui Public School Principal Bernard Constable, and the students, of course, Buddy, Izzy and Drew, and they were chatting there to Vanessa Milton. And that's all from the Australia-wide team for this Wednesday. I nearly forgot what day it was. Remember, you can podcast the show wherever you want to. Just go to the ABC Listen app and hit subscribe there. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.